Hello and welcome to the Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Stepanchik. On today's show, we'll hear a presentation by Daniel Gross with the Industrial Workers of the World and involved in organizing efforts in New York City area Starbucks. We'll also include a feature of news about media and democracy entitled Media Minutes. But first, let's hear these news briefs courtesy of The New Standard. A panel of judges uphold the Communications Decency Act. The governor of Massachusetts vetoes eased access to the morning after pill. The Pentagon rejects an order to release more Abu Ghraib abuse images. Public pressure may force soda makers to curb school sales. And the AFL-CIO pass resolutions in the face of defections. On the week of July 28, 2005, a three-judge panel shot down a challenge to a law barring the transmission of a wide variety of speech about alternative sexual expression because of the perceived threat such materials pose to minors. In deciding the case, Nitke v. Gonzalez, formerly Nitke v. Ashcroft, the United States District Court for the Southern District of New York upheld the prevailing broad definition of obscenity and noted that the Communications Decency Act of 1996, quote, prohibits any transmission of obscenity by means of the internet, unquote, unless age verification requirements or good faith efforts to prevent minors from viewing the material are undertaken. The plaintiff, Barbara Nitke, is an artist who photographs various sexual activities. Her lawsuit challenged the act as overly broad and unconstitutional, according to court papers. She also holds that the ban has deterred her from exercising her free speech rights. Joining Nitke in challenging the law was the National Coalition for Sexual Freedom, which bills itself as an organization committed to creating a political, legal, and social environment in the United States and advances equal rights of consenting adults who practice forms of alternative sexual expression, such as bondage, swinging, and polyamory. Obscenity is famously ill-defined. According to court papers, contemporary community standards, as set forth in the 1973 ruling, remains the prevailing definition. The governor of Massachusetts vetoed a measure on July 26, 2005 that would have broadened access to emergency contraception in the state by requiring hospitals to offer emergency contraception to rape survivors and allowing pharmacists to dispense the drug without a doctor's prescription. Emergency contraception, popularly known as the morning after pill, is a strong dose of hormones that, when taken soon enough after unprotected intercourse, can prevent an egg from being released, prevent fertilization of an egg, or prevent a fertilized egg from implanting in the uterus. Since the drug has no effect on an implanted egg, proponents of emergency contraception says that it does not cause an abortion. Pro-life groups disagree, tending to consider pregnancy to begin at fertilization. In defending the veto, which the legislature is widely expected to override, Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney said he had determined that the emergency contraceptives currently available sometimes cause an abortion rather than prevent pregnancy. Since he promised during his campaign not to alter the abortion laws of Massachusetts in either direction, he said, he was obligated to nix the bill. But reproductive rights groups charged the governor with breaking a campaign promise in support of emergency contraception. They protested Romney's decision, chanting, "Mitt Romney, we want the pill, keep your word, sign the bill," according to a report in the Boston Globe. Proponents of the measure also accused the governor of changing his mind on emergency contraception in order to make himself more appealing to conservatives as he considers a presidential run in 2008. Currently, emergency contraceptives are only available with a doctor's prescription in most of the United States. But since the drug is most effective when taken as soon as possible after unprotected intercourse, reproductive rights advocates have sought to increase ready access to it. So far, the Food and Drug Administration has failed to approve an application to make Plan B, a commercial form of the contraceptive, accessible over the counter. A few states have passed similar laws allowing pharmacists to dispense emergency contraceptives directly. Facing a court-imposed deadline to release photographs and video documenting numerous instances of torture and abuse at the now infamous U.S.-run Abu Ghraib detention facility in Iraq, lawyers for the Department of Defense, on the week of July 25, 2005, sent the court a letter stating their intention to file papers explaining why it will not adhere to the judge's orders, according to a report from civil liberties groups. The legal brief explaining the reasoning behind the decision will be sealed, meaning most of the information will not be made public, according to the letter. People who have seen the videos, including members of Congress and reporter Seymour Hersh, have reported they include scenes involving far worse abuses than have so far reached the public, including rape and lewd acts committed against and in front of prisoners. The deadline for the release of an estimated 100 photographs and 4 videos stems from a lawsuit filed after the Defense Department refused to fulfill Freedom of Information Act requests by several civil liberties and humanitarian groups. The original deadline was June 2, 2005, but a U.S. Circuit Court judge granted the government an extension to allow more time for redactions. The Center for Constitutional Rights expressed concern that the government is attempting to cover up the abuse that occurred at Abu Ghraib. So far, the government has released over 60,000 pages of documents related to the prison. All have been posted to the internet by the ACLU. The letter said, in part, that pictorial evidence of abuse could, quote, result in harm to individuals, unquote, according to a report in the New York Times. Assorted actions by several states and increasing pressure from public interest groups appears to be making headway with soft drink makers, as the largest industry group is reportedly weighing whether to impose its own restrictions on sales of the heavily sweetened beverages in elementary and high schools. In early July 2005, the Center for the Science in the Public Interest, a research organization, released a report warning that increasing use and consumption of carbonated and non-carbonated soft drinks is contributing to rising levels of obesity and other health problems. Since then, several states have made moves to regulate the sale of such beverages in schools. The North Carolina state legislature passed a measure banning the sale of soft drinks at elementary schools during breakfast and lunch periods and severely restricting their sales to high schools, according to a report from the Associated Press. The bill, Children Nutrition Standards, State Senate Bill 961, strengthens existing state law by prohibiting the sale of soft drinks to elementary school and middle school students. The measure also prohibits soda sales to high school students during periods set aside for meals and requires that the percentage of sugared beverages offered to high school students not exceed 50% of all available drinks. Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee announced that he was supporting efforts to restrict soft drink and other vending machine sales in the state schools after discussions with Arkansas Center for Health Improvement Director Joe Thompson, according to a report from the Associated Press. The proposals Huckabee supports would reportedly limit the size of soft drinks available to school children and restrict all vending machine sales to brief periods before and after the school day. California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger lent his support in an effort to extend a 2-year-old ban on soft drink sales at elementary schools to middle and high schools in the nation's most populous state. That state law was the first such effort in the nation. New Jersey and Louisiana have also imposed restrictions on the selling of sugary beverages to schools. In the wake of such developments, the American Beverage Association considers self-imposed restrictions on sales to schools, according to a report from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Industry leaders are expected to discuss the issue and possibly decide on it during a conference call. At its 2005 annual convention, the nation's largest labor organization passed resolutions calling for a greater emphasis on organizing and a quick withdrawal of United States military forces from Iraq, according to news accounts and reports from members attending the event. As part of a series of resolutions proposed by the Executive Council of the AFL-CIO, delegates to the convention approved the two resolutions and called for an emergency meeting to discuss the departure of two of the Federation's largest unions. The resolution on Iraq was amended on the convention floor to include a call for the rapid end to the Iraq occupation. In addition, the resolution demanded better veterans' benefits from the government and expressed solidarity with Iraqi workers. The same day, the Labor Federation passed a resolution calling for a renewed commitment to aggressively organizing U.S. workers, according to press accounts. Reuters reports that the vote approved $22.5 million for 2006 outreach efforts, double what leaders had previously sought. That vote reportedly came on top of a demand that member unions spend at least 30% of their resources on recruiting and mobilizing new members. The Associated Press reports that convention delegates also approved a measure to hold a meeting on how to deal with the defection by the International Brotherhood of Teamsters and the Service Employees International Union, who took 3.2 million members with them and cost the Federation about $18 million in annual membership dues. These brief reports come to us courtesy of The New Standard. We encourage you to support independent, nonprofit, anti-commercial news sources like The New Standard, on the web at newstandardnews.net. You're listening to the Ministry of Truth.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news relating to the intersection of media and democracy. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Kimberly Cronick.
Although telecom companies are leading state-level crusades to crush municipal broadband and community-run wireless networks, their greed has reached a new low in the state of Massachusetts. There, phone and cable companies have used tax loopholes to dramatically slash their property tax burdens to the tune of some $1.3 billion in the last 3 years. They're utilizing 100-year-old laws meant to spur the development of the original telephone system, and they're also transferring ownership of their cables, wires, conduits, and utility poles to holding companies based in Bermuda and other offshore tax havens. As a result, for example, Verizon's property tax bill to the city of Boston dropped from more than $3 million in 2003 to just $9,300 this year. The city's assessor says such corporate tax avoidance has increased other businesses' tax bills by at least 2% and raised residential property tax rates by close to $200. Now the telecom sector is fending off a bill in the state legislature that would close the tax loophole, claiming that such a move would result in dramatic rate increases.
Detroit has had a vibrant independent media scene for several decades now, first flourishing during the civil rights movement in the 1960s. Two people involved in that work spoke to attendees of the 7th Annual Allied Media Conference, held last month in Bowling Green, Ohio. The Allied Media Conference attracts hundreds of independent media producers from around the U.S., the largest gathering of its kind. Charles Simmons is now a journalism and law professor at Eastern Michigan University, and he helped found one of the first radical black newspapers in the Detroit area close to 40 years ago. He says at the time, the notion of media activism wasn't on anyone's radar.
We didn't consider ourselves media activists or media workers separate from being revolutionaries or being activists. And this was that we were activists. We wanted to change the country, change the world. And so media was an outgrowth of what we were doing.
Today, independent media remains alive and well in Detroit. Abayomi Azakiwe, founder of the Pan-African Newswire and host of radio programs in both Detroit and Toronto, says the explosion of digital technologies has opened up new spaces for new voices, which, with time, he believes will compete directly with mainstream newspapers and broadcast outlets.
People have their own independent radio programs, the webcasting, the use of iPod technology. This has been a boom to progressive circles in this country.
Azakiwe says it also pays to seek out information from unlikely sources. He's personally found the government is an excellent source for finding out more about the history of radical activism, both in Detroit and nationwide.
We got a lot of FBI files under the Freedom of Information Act, and in fact, they're one of the best repositories of movement literature in the country. They collected everything. Leaflets, newsletters, they had transcripts of radio programs and interviews and so forth.
But Detroit hasn't been without its problems. Massive economic depression has caused a major exodus. This has had a discernible impact on independent media in Detroit. For example, the Detroit Public Schools owned and operated an FM radio station up until April of this year, when budget cuts forced it to lease station operations to a public broadcaster who was changing the format and kicking community voices off the air. Both Simmons and Azakiwe agree that it is more important to work to build new media outlets focused on providing quality information than it is to try and break into the so-called mainstream media. Taking their cue from the tactics of guerrilla warfare, both feel that with time, the proliferation of smaller voices will eventually meet and exceed the reach of larger, centralized information outlets.
And now, here's a Media Minutes Fast Fact. For the first time ever, the growth of broadband internet connections overtakes the growth of Pokie dial-up service. As of 2004, just over half the U.S. residential net connections in use were at dial-up speeds, but in the first quarter of 2005, more new broadband connections went online than did new dial-up customers. At the end of the year, the percentage split between home broadband and dial-up is predicted to be 60-40. Yet in South Korea, which ranks as the number one wired country in the world, consumers can get broadband connections up to 5 times faster than what's available in America and at a cheaper price. Currently, 76% of South Korean homes are connected to some sort of broadband service. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a joint production of the Illinois Initiative for Media Policy Research at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization dedicated to media democracy. For more information, visit our website at freepress.net.
Ah, the cable bill's here.
$100? And it still doesn't work right. And they just came to fix it. Every month it seems like we pay more and get less.
Are you tired of high cable bills, poor customer service, and feel like there's nothing you can do about it? Well, now's your chance. The Federal Communications Commission is deciding on rules that could allow your cable company to grow even larger, giving them unchecked power to raise your rates, restrict your internet, dictate which programming channels you receive, and limit local programming. Don't let the cable industry be the only voice heard on these important decisions. The FCC needs to hear from you. Has your cable company been accountable to your community? Visit www.grassrootscable.com to learn more and to take action today. It's time for the public to be heard.
This is the Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Strapinchik. We now feature an excerpt of a presentation by Daniel Gross, an organizer with the Industrial Workers of the World, who is involved in organizing workers in New York City area Starbucks. Gross spoke at the centennial anniversary conference of the Industrial Workers of the World, held in Chicago on June 25, 2005.
My name is Daniel Gross. I'm a barista at the 36 Madison Starbucks in Manhattan. Brothers and sisters, our working hypothesis is that if we can wrest control of the labor movement from the AFL, we can create a true movement. I want to point out one of the things I think is remarkable about our campaign. Unlike the AFL, we don't use a small cadre of so-called professional organizers to try to organize workers. We envision and we participate in a campaign that depends on community folks and workers on the shop floor in their local community to help build the union. And I'm actually going to illustrate that with people sitting in this room. For example, Harjeet Gill. You know him as the talented and gracious organizer that brought in over 200 truckers to this union. He's also our local campaign contact in the Bay Area. So when we get reached out to by a Starbucks worker, we work together with Harjeet and others on the ground there to move forward. We have Nicole Schulman here. Nicole Schulman is the co-editor of the beautiful Wobbly graphic novel. Nicole has done, I guess it's dozens of events promoting the graphic novel, and at every single one she mentions our campaign. She explains how to get involved. She's done radio interviews with Starbucks workers, and she's done a fundraiser for us, and she's donated generously a book to the campaign. John Becken has kept the union updated in the Industrial Worker. Paul Bocking from Peterborough, Canada, started a student movement on his campus to deny Starbucks from entering and starting a shop because of their union busting in New York. Thank you, Paul. People here, you know who you are, the New Jersey Wobs who always work the bar at our fundraiser, Sam Morales, our heart and soul in New York, our go-to guy, Nathaniel Miller that'll proofread documents for us after we've seen him 10 times and we can't find the errors, but he always does. We came together at 36 in Madison for a few reasons. Number one, despite Starbucks' assiduously crafted socially responsible image, the company does not pay a living wage. And to me, the most stark element of their pay system is that every Starbucks retail hourly employee in the United States, so that's bussers, baristas, and shift supervisors, is a part-time worker. Every single one. Starbucks has conceded to this. That means that when we show up at work and we get our schedule, we can have 25 hours of work. If we spoke up a little bit, we didn't like something that happened last week and we complained, maybe we'll have 17 hours. You can get 12, 10. Obviously, it's exceedingly difficult to budget for necessities when you have no idea how much income you're going to take in at the end of the month. Starbucks also has shown a reckless disregard to the physical integrity of workers. Repetitive strain injuries are the dirty little secret at Starbucks. The reasons are twofold. Number one, the company has not shown the slightest interest in even the most basic and fundamental ergonomic standards. So the workplace is chock full of cumbersome bending and reaching and just unnecessary motions. Couple that with management's continued refusal to schedule enough workers on the shop floor to meet the extraordinary demand that a Starbucks coffee shop faces each and every day. Brothers and sisters, this is not your grandma's coffee shop. This is a McDonald's-like entity in every sense of the word, and we turn out hundreds of hot drinks per shift at lightning speeds. The repetitive strain is inevitable, but not surprising. Starbucks launched a vicious anti-union campaign. Chairman Howard Schultz and the company are running one of the greatest con games in corporate America today. If I had a dime for every liberal, conservative, moderate, non-affiliated, you name it, who said to us, "But isn't Starbucks a different kind of company? Isn't it a different kind of capitalism?" Sadly, friends, no. The anti-union campaign has been terroristic in nature. I've had workers call me late at night, can't sleep, my stomach hurts. In addition to the propaganda campaign, the battle for hearts and minds, the boss attempts to create such a stressful environment that even if you don't agree with what the boss is telling you, the day-to-day grind is so intense, and of course the solution is offered. Shy away from those wobblies. You guys will get a kick out of this, actually. One of their anti-union postings, it said, partners, they call us partners. Did you know that the IWW advocates an overthrow of capitalism? The overthrow of capitalism, the economic foundation of the United States. Don't take our word for it. Here's their preamble. Forget it, Maureen Medianero, young single mother, best person in the world. I take a bullet for her. She had just got sat down. Alex Perez, the district manager, had laid into her, served her with the document. You know, she listened, she made some comments, and then she walked back to me and she had this smile on her face. Of course, she had been prepared for what was gonna come in the inoculation effort. And she said, "Daniel, Alex Perez is taking home $125,000 a year, and he thinks I should care about the economic foundation of the United States." So despite the anti-union campaign, we've been able to chalk up some victories we're very proud of, and I'll just run through them quickly. We won an across-the-board wage increase. New York, instead of $7.75, baristas started $8.25. Still far from a living wage, but nonetheless, more money ending up in workers' pockets. We're happy about that. Starbucks has finally stopped denying the prevalence of repetitive strain injury in their new employee manual, in their new employee training, and in their September security and safety bulletin that goes out to 80,000 workers. They concede that the espresso bar, in particular, is a source of repetitive strain like carpal tunnel syndrome. They offer some little exercises you can do, like stretch your toes back and forth to try to avoid these things. So we're still far from a solution, but like an addict, we push them past the denial phase. The solution is the comprehensive ergonomic overhaul and appropriate staffing, but forward progress. The third is that, and talking to some folks, it seems like now that maybe a first in low entry-level retail, but many Starbucks workers were given a fairly substantial, for us, Christmas bonus at the end of 2004, approximately $250, which when you make the kind of money we make, goes a long way. You're able to, you know, maybe go to movies with the kids if you have children, buy some extra presents. So we're very happy about that. This is a different kind of campaign. We depend on you to make this happen, to build this union. Money obviously is not our strong suit. The asymmetrical resources are our start. The website is starbucksunion.org. It's an interactive website. The single most profound thing you can do to lend us a hand is to print out our outreach flyer in your local community. Chat up the Starbucks workers, the Dunkin' Donut workers, the Gap workers, whoever else, Taco Bell workers, and let them know that they have a right to form a union, and that VIWW is finally here. Thanks to the industrial workers of the world, on our 100th anniversary, retail is no longer uncharted territory.
That was Daniel Gross, an organizer with the Industrial Workers of the World, involved in organizing workers in New York City area Starbucks. To learn more about the Industrial Workers of the World, go online to iww.org. You're listening to the Ministry of Truth.